This is the Lattice Training Podcast, where we bring you the best in climbing performance and training from the world's elite athletes, thought leaders, and coaches. Hello, everyone who has tuned into the Lattice Training Podcast today. This is Tom, and I have a guest, Allegra Maguire, who recently joined me for an episode, all topics-based climbing psychology. And we were talking about the concepts of fixed mindset and growth mindset and how those relate to training and performance. Now, Allegra is a mental coach and is also the co-founder of Climb in Flow and has a YouTube channel called Climbing Psych, which is really good. A lot of great videos on there. And she's also a PhD student in decision making at Linköping University in Sweden. As part of her work in climbing, she works with professional and non-professional athletes and very much has a blend of practical science that's then applied into her work with her athletes. And so I'm really excited to have her on the show again to really think about how we use the theory in certain parts of psychology and apply that across into our practice in sport. And obviously, we're climbers. Today's topic is the individual zone of optimal functioning. I know a very small amount about this, but before we dive into this topic, I just want to say welcome to Allegra, welcome back, and we're ready to get going again.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Now, Allegra, can you tell me what this phrase, individual zone of optimal functioning, means? Because I sort of know, but I'm not 100% sure. So can you just totally spell this out for us and explain what it is?
Absolutely. The individual zone of optimal functioning is that emotional recipe that allows us to reach our peak level performances depending on the situation. So this theory was developed by Jüri Hanin and around 15 years ago and has been developed ever since. Received a lot of praise because they looked into those different personality traits or personality differences between athletes, because this is theory that was developed into sport psychology, not driven by research in another sector and then translated into sport. It was born into sport. And it looked at how different athletes respond differently to different kinds of situations and how emotions drive different levels of performance. So I think one of the most striking results is that we usually identify emotions are positive or negative. So we usually identify like happiness as positive and sadness as negative or angriness as negative. However, when it comes to performance and the level of achievement, different constellations of different emotions can drive different profiles. So, for example, cheerfulness, which is something that is usually considered positive, in certain sport contexts can be considered negative. Think, for example, if you're doing a combat sport. Mm-hmm. If you're cheerful and very friendly towards your opponent, then that might not be the best type of mindset or emotion that you would want to feel during a match.
Yeah, I totally get that.
Sometimes aggressiveness is considered as very negative, but if you go into sports that, for example, rugby, aggressiveness is a crucial part in trying to scare your opponent. And so having that little edge against them. And when it comes to climbing, we can see that some climbers have the tendency to perform when angry. And angriness, I think, is one of the most interesting emotions when it comes to sport, because it can be perceived so differently from person to person. And it's also one of these emotions that are more difficult to deal with. So managing frustration, managing if you get angry at yourself versus angry at the conditions or how you perceive luck. And how does this impact your emotions really can change dramatically your performance, your mindset, and how focused you are on the situation. So The individual zone of optimal functioning is a theory that aims at identifying the best profile for each athlete at the different kinds of situation. So when the theory was developed, the two main situations that were mapped were training and performing.
Oh, so looked at both of those?
Yes.
Okay, interesting.
When I look into it in climbing, I don't just divide it in these two. I look at training, and then it depends on the certain types of training. But especially when it comes to performing, I profile my athletes in the type of climbing they have to do. So if you have to climb a technical slab, I expect my climber to have a different mindset that is optimal compared to doing a very powerful boulder. So I will try to map different kinds of styles that the athlete has to encounter, especially in bouldering. So in bouldering is more variegated. When it comes to lead climbing, then it's a more generalized kind of pattern of emotions. But especially when it comes to bouldering, we identify the profile for the different kind of style. So we usually have one for slab, one for overhanging powerful boulders, and then we have one for coordination moves. And what you really want to map is the emotions that really allow you to perform and those emotions that really drowns you. So it's not just about finding the sweet spot for that one emotion. You want to look at them at the same time. And maybe you can't control, like bring to zero one emotion. For example, levels of activation, how excited you are, how reactive you are to stimuli. Maybe you can't bring it to a super low degree, but having it slightly decreased can have a very influential impact in performance. So it's not super easy, but at the same time, when you work on those emotions that drive the, for example, the complete drop into performance, then you can have striking results.
Hmm. So going back to the original work and the theory that was done when it was developed in this area of psychology, what exactly were they doing to map this out? Because it sounds quite complex, because we identify that there's a whole number of different factors mm-hmm. and traits that you want to have in different positions for different sports.
Yeah.
That to me seems entirely logical, because sports are very different in terms of their execution. Mm-hmm. But we're not black boxes that you can, or, you know, transparent boxes that we can go back into and just have a look exactly what's going on in the hard wiring in a human brain. So how's this even done in the first place? Because you know where I'm going to go with that next is, how do we do this for ourselves for climbing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the most interesting things is that when you try to assess the individual zone of optimal functioning, you don't just look at the set types of emotions and then you see, oh, are you performing well when you're angry? Are you performing well when you're sad? It's actually the athlete themselves that can select the emotions that they found most, or moods, for example, that they found most impactful in their performance. So we have some questionnaires that looked into very common features and emotions. However, the first studies were really looking qualitatively and quantitatively at the athletes and see which were the different constellations of emotions that were driving the result. And then through the analysis of this, you transform these qualitative elements, are the emotions and moods, and then you place them into a questionnaire, and then the athlete is able to rate their own performance depending on the different emotions and situation, and then you do it with the coach as well. So mm-hmm. you have these two perspectives and must be integrated, because otherwise you have some kind of biases towards self-criticism, for example, that is very well known with athletes. And so it gives a bit more complex and sometimes more realistic perspective. And this is still how it's done today. Let's say that more closed, structured questionnaires with the predetermined emotions are still used. However, this is the most effective way to map the different performances. Of course, coaches play a huge role and giving feedback in this kind of situation, but one should be able, if they have enough insight, to map their own emotions. And one of the best ways to do so, since I know you're going to ask me how to do it, is definitely journaling. So tracking, writing down how you feel, how you felt, and the different kinds of, for example, temps, situations, what were your thoughts, and how you perceived your emotion impacted your performance is one of the best ways really to see whether that emotion is driving or your performance towards a better or worse outcome. Then, of course, you have environmental feedback as well. So you can see that sometimes, as I said, we have attentional biases that drives our attention towards especially negative elements, negative stimuli. So we might have the tendency to see, for example, angriness as negative, because maybe you were completely blinded by that emotion, and in that situation, it completely destroyed your performance. However, when you have a certain amount, certain level of intensity, let's pretend that maybe being angry on a scale from 0 to 10, on a scale of 8, completely disrupts your performance. But having a 6, so you're definitely angry, that makes you spark. Mm. So you're really putting out the intensity that is necessary to put out that 1% more, the top 1% of your abilities to really perform at your best. So an athlete might believe that being angry might be something impairing their performance. However, if they have enough feedback or from coaches, from climbers that climb around with you, so like, I saw you, you were activated and you performed really well, then you can understand that maybe you can try to tune that emotion to exactly the level that you need to perform at your best.
Okay, yeah, so that's interesting. I definitely get the side of recognizing that those negative emotions and how those might actually be useful, mm-hmm. and you can tune those to a set level. That seems quite intuitive, and I can sort of practically do that. Where I think it's harder to understand what you should actually do is, and so on your first point with the journaling, because I think about that and go, okay, yeah, I can write a journal. I can write down mm-hmm. how I felt about different sessions, but it feels very woolly to try and understand and map that out for myself, especially given that for me, maybe 1 in 10 sessions, I kind of feel on it mm-hmm. and I know that's a good session.
Okay.
And I can do it. So I almost feel like I don't have enough examples of good sessions to start to map the thing out and grasp it. So how does that journaling work on a functioning basis?
But wait. It's not that you just have to map good sessions. The thing is that you want to map also the other sessions in which you didn't really perform at your top level. Right. So that you can see, that is an attentional bias, remember.
Okay.
Don't forget that we need to see the development of the emotions and all the factors that drive performance in different situations. So you have to map even those sessions that weren't, let's say, profitable in terms of performance, that wasn't like on top level, so that you can see whether the emotion actually makes a difference. Maybe sometimes it doesn't even make much of a difference. And then you learn that maybe if you feel that kind of emotion, you don't have to worry about it, which decreases the level of cognitive worry, which is one of the three main factors for two main factors for performance. And the other one is physiological anxiety. So how you're like somatic feelings of anxiety. But there are some, for example, tables that you can give to athletes so that they know exactly what they have to map. So they can map the type of session that they had. And when it comes to competitions, especially when it comes to bouldering, as I said, with bouldering is a bit more fine-tuned, you have to map each boulder and each try. So it's better if you have videos so the athlete can go through and think, oh yeah, I remember this. I remember that I was thinking about this and I felt in this kind of thing. So you would want to know what was the activating event, what was the thought related to that activating event, and what was the consequence in the terms of emotions and feelings. And so there is a very systematic way of journaling these kind of emotions and reactions to different kind of stimuli. And that way, if you do it in the long run, then you can see patterns. Mm. Of course, it can't be a single type of situation. If you're mapping, for example, a competition, there are different levels of competition, the different types. And with some, you'll have more pressure because from that competition, you will derive your possibility to go into higher level competition, or it might be a smaller competition with maybe an open, which has no real consequence, and pressure might be decreased. So all of these elements must be taken into consideration to when you look at the profile. But there are more or less systematic ways of doing it. Sometimes even just writing down thoughts, activating events and consequences is enough. Otherwise, you can have your own table and you do it for specific, like structurally to from each session.
And can people find this stuff just on the internet? Like, what would they Google or search if they wanted to find some of these tables or lists of things that they want to pay attention to? Because I'm sure lots of people listening go, ah, okay, that's interesting. There's a system out there. There's a way of doing this. Some of the stuff must be written down somewhere.
Yes, absolutely. So this system that I was talking about, like activating event beliefs and consequences, comes from Albertelli's work with the rational emotional behavioral therapy, which is the predecessor of cognitive behavioral therapy. And it's called ABC.
Mm-hmm.
And you can apply to basically anything. And that is a great way of journaling and keeping track of emotions and situations, because then you can see the connection between the event and how an event can drive different kinds of cognition. So beliefs and thoughts that you have around that event, and how these thoughts actually determine the types of reaction that you have. And this is an extremely powerful instrument, because it shows you that it's not the event itself that derives your reaction, is what you think about that event, and helps a lot with like inside and how you reevaluate those events and what are the different kinds of cognitions, beliefs and thinking, thoughts that you can have regarding that event, which sparks different kinds of behaviors and feelings. So you won't be able to find something that is specific to sport. This is something that I translated into sport that is used by sports psychologists generally in everything. I have it specifically for my athletes in bouldering. There's nothing that online that you can find it on bouldering specifically.
Right, because this is a very new area and very people new. Are developing their own methodologies.
I mean, there's no study on individual zone of optimal functioning in climbing yet. Maybe I should do something about it. However, it's a very solid line of research. We know that the ABC model is very fruitful when it comes to this topic. So it's definitely something that is worth digging into. And as I said, it's very useful to change, to try to challenge your thoughts, your beliefs, and can drive a very big positive change in athletes and in general in people. I would suggest to read Albert Ellis to anyone, then no matter if you're interested in performance or anything. It's a great framework. It's very enlightening. He has decades of working to, so he was a psychotherapist, of course.
Mm.
And it's a great instrument, extremely, extremely practical. Albertelli is extremely practical in everything that he's done around research and psychotherapy. So it's an instrument that I think would be of great use, notwithstanding where you apply it.
And once people understood or understand what their zone of optimal
functioning
is, how do they get into that zone almost on demand? Because I'm guessing that you can practice this and become more and more efficient and able to do this under almost any circumstance, any environment. What are the tools that people have at their disposal to do this?
Absolutely. I work with the individual zone of optimal functioning with high-end athletes only. Most cases, yes, this is a situation. So the first thing is that they need to learn to apply them when it comes to training and simulations. So it's an instrument that, it's a framework that must be interiorized. So otherwise, when people get into high pressure situations, we just forget about them and we'll not have them interiorized. But there are different techniques that are used. And it's interesting because usually you don't have to implement them yourself. It's something that you can pick up from the athlete themselves. But one of the most powerful is routines. I think one of the most famous routine that people don't realize it's routine, but it is Magnus Milbo's shirt off for extra power. That is absolutely a routine. It's that kind of behavior that you do that gives you that idea, okay, now I want to perform, now I want to get to that top 1% of effort that I can put into it, and really changes your level of focus and intensity that you're going to put.
And what makes a routine? Because let's say Magnus mm-hmm. does this or someone else does it.
Yeah.
We're saying for Magnus, this is a routine and this yes. is something that gets into him into his zone of optimal functioning. Someone else I see takes their shirt off and it doesn't put them in their zone of optimal
yeah,
functioning.
Exactly.
And we would say maybe it's not a routine. How do I know the difference between those two things? The routine element, this practice hundreds, thousands of times and tied to a particular intention with what they're doing. So it's, I've done this 1,000 times and when I take my top off for power as such, I'm going, now it's time to, you know, go to war, or this is when I get in my zone. Is that what it's all about?
Yes, basically. It's something that must be personal. Of course, you can try to take off your t-shirt, but if you're concerned, for example, about your body shape, then definitely maybe that's not the best kind of mindset that you want to put yourself into. Usually people tend to spontaneously create those kinds of routines. Some people like chalk up in a specific type of way. I see some athletes that they have a specific order with which they come to the mat. And so they first take the dirt off the shoes with their towels, then they chalk up, then they maybe clap their hands or maybe they blow on the hand, and then they look, they start reading. And some other people might do specific type of routines that are like a bit more on the
OCD?
No, it's not really OCD. It's like superstition.
Okay, right. Lucky practices.
Something that really puts you into the mindset, like, now is when I want to perform. I'm doing everything that I can to put myself in that mindset so that I can perform. Some people will tie their shoes in a specific type of way. You know, some athletes do in other sports. They have laces. But some others might be, instead, chalking up in a specific type of way. Or in the way they take off the excess of chalk, usually. So if you're taking off on your trousers, you can use different levels of intensity. Some people don't really realize that they really slap their trousers harder, so they're increasing their level of activation. And others change the way of breathing. So breathing itself can become kind of routine. So if you know, if you're having to do something technical and you need to slow down, you know, you see a lot in comp style climbing now, these boulders in which you have to change the rhythm of the climb throughout the boulder, then you know you need to slow down to not be rushed. Mm. And then you can try to take deep breaths and slow down your heartbeat, get more focused on being precise and be more aware of where your foot are and how do the foothold feel and how does it feel. On the contrary, if you have to do something very powerful, then you might want to increase your level of oxygenation of the muscles, and you can take deeper breath, but quicker, and improve that sensation of energy that comes from breathing. And again, that can be a routine itself. Breathing is extremely useful itself, because it can regulate some, again, physiological symptoms or reactions that are linked to the anxiety. So one of the parameters for deciding the intensity of the different emotions. So again, I was stated, so to be clear. So the three parameters are pressure, which is not in your control to a certain degree. Then you have cognitive worry, what are your thoughts about the situation, and physiological worry. So all the kinds of reaction that you can have when you're in that situation of pressure. That could be sweating, that could be increased heartbeat. Sweating is especially special for climbing, because, you know, it impacts a lot when we think about our performance. And it could be like a lot of athletes have the feeling that the urgency to have to go to the bathroom, or they might have a stomach ache. Cramps in the stomach, a lot of symptoms that can disrupt focus. And then again, you could have cognitive worry. So how your competitor is going, if you hear the crowd screaming, then you know the opponent got the top, and all these kind of intrusive thoughts that can get in between. And breathing can decrease the level of activation of your autonomous system, nervous system. And so you can regulate the physiological part of anxiety a bit more.
It's interesting you said about the routine element, because it took me back to a realization that I had some years ago with the taping up that I do before I go climbing. So my zone of, you know, optimal performance at excellence is in crack climbing. Yeah. And it's probably the bit where I've spent most of my climbing career really dialing into getting that just right. And I noticed a number of years ago that when I would sit down and start to tape up before climbing, I just got into such a good mindset and good zone. And now it's so, so tied to that, almost to the point where I'm somewhat tempted just to do it, even if I don't tape up, because it's a very specific routine. And I would get halfway through the job and go, I am feeling amazing. I'm so motivated to climb very hard, but be really calm and be really in my zone. And so it's interesting to see how that, can develop over time and becomes a very, very useful tool that you can deploy and use again and again. And I've even refined it to the point where I will do a number of different types of taping depending on what kind of zone I want to get into. Amazing. And I can notice the difference on those nowadays. So it's a very doable thing.
And the great thing is that you've choosing a routine that is absolutely in your control. So for example, taking off your shirt might not be the best kind of routine. If you're going to a competition, you cannot compete without a shirt. So if you are a competition climber, and you know that is your primary routine or primary tool there with which you go into the zone, then that's dangerous. Because then you don't have control into it to 100% degree. Or think about outdoor bouldering. If it's super cold, or if it's super, especially if it's cold conditions, and maybe you don't want to take off your shirt. It might be, or in the US, there are some places in which you cannot take your shirt off because of public decency. Right, so you are restricting your ability to get into that zone. In that case, you want to have a multiple types of routines so that you can reinforce another one that is completely in your control, like taping, like the way you chalk up, or the warm-up routine that you do.
And how does music work within all of this?
Music is one of the most strongest and, let's say, most accessible ways to tune yourself into your optimal zone. And that is because it's so easy to find, like, playlists that are so spot on for the type of mindset that you want to. Usually, for example, a lot of people have struggle finding the motivation for training, and they might feel sluggish. And music can change so much the way you feel about yourself and feel about the idea of training. That is incredible. So athletes, when they go before the competition, they're not allowed to bring their cell phones. So you can see some athletes just having those very like 90s or early 2000 times iPods or like MP3 players, so that they can choose those kind of songs that really put them in that kind of mindset. Maybe you want to have a like slightly calmer music if you know that you have to do the, as I said, the technical slab, or you can have something like techno music to do that kind of I use it for like more powerful kind of climbing, and then you can have or maybe like coordination moves, something that activates you, and then you have metal like when you know that you really need to like push yourself and go through the pain. That helps so much. And my athletes use it too for the competitions, and I have some clients that use it for training. So sometimes like doing anything, doesn't matter if it's really the intensity that it was into your program or that you were looking forward to do it. Sometimes like you really don't feel like training, and doing something compared to doing nothing is always better. So music can give you that little push to initiate the behavior. And then sometimes, well, you do that little that you can do that is within your control. Sometimes it can totally change your mindset, and then you go into an explosive session. Sometimes it can be just average, but the idea is that can give you that little push to initiate the behavior. And usually that is the biggest friction for training as well. So music is one of the like my favorite types of suggestions on how to, let's say, control your own moods and emotions, since you are the one that knows yourself the best.
Yeah, I can totally see that. And I think that's probably the one where most people listening will go, yeah, I get that. And probably most people are somewhat practiced in that. We've all done it. You know, people even do it for exams and studying and all sorts of things, being creative. So that feels, yeah, a very practiced thing. What about self-talk?
Self-talk is definitely one of the ways by which you can tune yourself into a specific type of mindset. It is linked to routines, again. You can see climbers that have their own like mantras. So Jerry Moffat, I remember his book, he said that his mantra was, what was it? Focused aggression.
Okay,
yeah. I found that very, because you can totally feel that he has like aggressivity, you know, like angriness, aggression, being aggressive into his zone of optimal functioning when it comes to going into like hard climbs. And those kind of words can help you remind you what you need to do in terms of the level of activation that you want to do. Or self-talk that is directed towards technique is also very useful to like tune focus if you really need to pay attention to something specifically. And also self-talk can be important in the terms of negative self-talk. When you realize that you have an intrusive thought, that it is negative, so dysfunctional, it's important to recognize it and use specific strategies so that you can tune yourself again, the focus where you need. So for example, you can use routine again to tune yourself again into like paying more attention to what is important. One of my favorite redirecting attention routines is tightening your shoe. Again, so I always tell my athletes that if you feel that you're thinking about like, I have to do this boulder first try, because otherwise I don't get the podium, not compared to I want to do it first try, the want versus need, it's very important with climbers in general. When they feel very important pressure, very big pressure, then, and we know it's disruptive, then I tell them, recognize this self-talk, recognize this intrusive self-talk, that it's something that you don't want to, then what do you do instead of trying to suppress it because we know it doesn't work. Accept it. It's there. Redirect attention to something that is more on the present. So tightening your shoe takes you literally 2 seconds. You feel the sensation of the shoe that is tightened really close to your foot. And then you can think about again where you are, what you have in front of you. And rather than thinking about, again, the performance that you have to achieve, you think about the process that you need to achieve it. And refocus the attention through routines by knowing your self-talk.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, it's really interesting to see these approaches. I think listening to everything that you've gone through on that zone of optimal functioning, if I think about people that I see and worked with on a regular basis, and just even friends as well in climbing, is that it feels like the area where people have the greatest opportunity, and they don't put a lot of practice in on this particular topic, is I don't think, and I don't know whether you agree, that people aren't very good at actually recognizing what their zone of optimal functioning looks like. I think plenty of people grasp how to do routines, use music, breathing, etc., yeah. Self-talk. They can do that polishing bit at the end, but the actual identifying, I think, really poor understanding from a lot of people. And it feels like, having listened to you today, I'm going, everyone needs to go and do that mapping exercise. That's the bit here that people need to get on with.
It requires a lot of experience too. So the more, of course, conscious about how it works, how does it look? It's not just one emotion, it's a recipe, really. And its complexity, how it relates to cognitive worry, physiological anxiety. It's not complex, it's not simple itself. Like when you look at graphs and how it looks, it's a three-dimensional graph, it's not even two-dimensional. It's a pretty complex theory. However, even just like understanding a bit more the role of each, like our emotions, that emotions, primarily, I think one of the biggest take-home messages is that emotions are not always an impairment. It's not so always an obstacle for your performance. Actually embrace them, understand them better, try to control them to a certain degree, to what is functional for you. Suppressing them is different. Like controlling is a bit of a word, problematic word. However, we can regulate our emotion to a certain extent. And understanding that they're not necessarily negative is a really a big step forward, I believe, for a lot of people, really eye-opening. And then the more you understand it, the more insight you develop and you look into how you function, the better you can map yourself. It takes, again, experience. It takes time. And it's better if there's someone qualified that can do it for you and like can see you with more objective eyes, and if you can get feedback from the environment that is functional and helpful, then it's much easier. But it's definitely approachable for everyone. We have this internal eye. We can look into ourselves as much as we can, and I think it's not something that obscure as like unconscious processes. It's something that you feel. It's I think it's definitely understandable for a vast majority of people and very overlooked.
Yeah, I've loved this. This has been really, really interesting. And I definitely identify with so much of this, because as a professional athlete myself, I spent lots of time trying to explore this area, but more mm-hmm. intuitively, and sort of discovering my own path and things. For anyone listening who is interested in finding out more about you and, you know, the work that you do, and obviously I know that you work with athletes to do this precise work. Yes. Where can they find you? Where can they locate you, find you more about the sort of stuff that you're putting out there in terms of content or just direct contact?
Yes. For coaching, you can contact me through climbingflow.com. If you're interested in this type of topics, you can definitely find a lot of information on my YouTube channel, Climbing Psych. And if you're looking forward to see like how I, for example, apply sports psychology to my own self, I show it a lot on Instagram, along with a lot of random random elements that you can find, or you can contact me directly through Instagram as well.
Well, thank you for coming on the show again today. It's been great chatting to you.
Always big pleasure.
Always love a bit of this stuff. And hopefully we'll catch up again soon.
Thank you.